Part by a grant from Birkenstock Concepts by Heel to Toe in downtown Urbana. For over 25 years, offering all sizes and widths of Birkenstocks, from clogs and sandals to work, dress, and sport shoes. Birkenstock Concepts offers repair and modification services and a certified podorthist and orthotist on staff. Today's programming is made possible in part by grants from 10,000 Villages in downtown Champaign and Crossroads Global Handcrafts, 428 North Main in Bloomington, offering a collection of products from more than 30 third world countries, from Vietnamese ceramics and textiles to Bolivian musical instruments and international home decor.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for tuning in today. Our guest in this portion of the program, Howard Rosenberg. For 25 years, Howard Rosenberg was the television critic for the Los Angeles Times. Prior to joining the Times, he worked for 8 years at the Louisville Times. He's watched and written a great deal about the medium. His work earned him a Pulitzer Prize for criticism. Howard Rosenberg retired from the LA Times in 2003. Today he teaches news ethics in the Annenberg School and criticism in the Film Television School at the University of Southern California. Rosenberg is a tough critic. If you aren't familiar with the criticism he wrote while at the LA Times, you can find a sampling of his work in a collection of his columns. Not So Prime Time, Chasing the Trivial on American Television. In the preface to the book, Rosenberg says, "Television is distinctive, not inferior by definition, and its warts should not be rationalized any more than a bad play or novel should be excused. I write some tough things about television, but that severity comes out of respect for its potential." Listeners, I invite you to join the discussion this afternoon, your questions, comments, your criticism. Welcome. Join us with a telephone call. If you're listening in the Champaign-Urbana area, the number 333-9455. Anywhere else, if it would be a long-distance call, use the toll-free number 800-222-9455. In addition to the Pulitzer, Howard Rosenberg has been honored with 2 National Headliner Awards. His book, Not So Prime Time, Chasing the Trivial on American Television, is published by Ivan R. D. 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Howard Rosenberg, thanks so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you. Listen, I heard your intro. Does this mean we're not going to talk about Illini basketball?
I hope not. There's plenty of that in this community today.
I can imagine.
Yeah, so we'll go in a different direction here today. I thought what we'd do is maybe talk a little bit in general about television, then talk about news coverage, and then, you know, maybe also if we have some time, talk about entertainment.
Yeah, sure.
Okay. As I mentioned in my introduction, you write at the outset of your book, at the introduction to your book, Not So Prime Time, "I write some tough things about television, but that severity comes out of respect for its potential."
Yeah.
How far are we from the potential of the medium?
Well, it's hard to know because we can't see into the future and what the technology will bring. But I know we haven't come close really to reaching it. And, you know, I would say that about all the arts. You know, when I teach at USC, one of the things I preach to my students in criticism is I never want to see them write, "Well, it's okay for TV," because I don't think there should be double standards. You know, most movies that are made are not good. Most music written is not good. Most books written are not good. And the same is true of television. The difference is we don't read every book, see all the movies, hear all the music, but people watch a lot of television and get the impression that somehow, percentage-wise, it's less than the other art forms. And I really don't think that's true, but I still think there's enormous room for improvement. And the way to improve it is, I think, to lift the critical awareness of the public so the public will demand more, because ultimately, you know, what we get is what we want.
Yeah. What do you think is holding television back from its potential? Is it our lack of being tougher, being more critical of the medium?
Well, I think a lot of it is a responsibility of the public, but also I think we become desensitized by what we're confronted by. It's like if you buy a piece of furniture and you really dislike it, but 6 months later you don't even seem to notice it. It's just there. And a lot of television is furniture. It's what we get used to. It's a very addictive medium, and it's very easy to be exposed to without thinking critically. And, you know, I think the danger is that if you let it, will wash over you like you're a mindless drone. And so I think we should always ask more of it. Not that television at times is not a medium that is escapism. There's nothing wrong with escapism. But it has so much potential to inform and enlighten. And I think so little of that potential is being reached.
Mm. What's out there today that you're encouraged by? What do you see on the tube that you like?
Well, in terms of news media, and much of my book is about news media, not a lot. I have a real bleak outlook about where the media in this country are going, and especially the electronic media. And I think the biggest challenge facing media today is speed. Speed because of technology. It's this cockamamie thing called the 24-hour news cycle that was sort of introduced with the creation of CNN in 1980. And I think because of that, today, television in conjunction with talk radio, in conjunction with media bloggers, we are now on this perilous fast track of information in which there is a great danger of rushing to premature conclusions and giving no one, the media, the public, government officials, time to think. There's just not enough time to think about anything. I'll create a fictional scenario for you. Let's say it's 9 a.m. in the morning, and there's a rumor out that President Bush has passed gas. By 10 a.m., the 24-hour news networks are doing live stand-ups from the White House lawn about the president's gaseousness. An hour later, they've all assembled panels on flatulence who are analyzing it. By mid-afternoon, the bloggers have it on the Internet. And then by 3 or 4 in the afternoon, Sean Hannity and Rush Limbaugh have attributed the president's flatulence to some kind of media liberal conspiracy. Then it makes the evening news shows. And it goes on through the evening on more of the 24-hour stuff, until it even enters the monologues of Letterman and Leno. And even though the next morning it's disproved, it doesn't make any difference because 50% of the people still believe it because it's out there in the ether. And the media have achieved what they really want to achieve, and that is fill space, fill time. And that is one of the great dangers of this 24-hour news cycle. You have CNN, you have Fox, you have MSNBC, with these enormous news holes to fill, and the only way they can fill it is to reach out and grab at anything that's available.
Yeah.
That's not a positive answer. That's a negative answer.
Yeah. And how long does it take before the networks, cable or broadcast, have a special packaging, a special logo to go with that story? I mean, it becomes...
Of course it's out there. I mean, much of them treat almost everything like some kind of entertainment. And you're exactly right. Inevitably, there will be a special logo. There will be musical accompaniment. And it's treated like a piece of entertainment, which also is dangerous, I think.
Yeah. Well, what about the positive?
Well, I don't see, you know, look, there are individual journalists in terms of news media. There are individual journalists who are good, and some of them still shine through until he just left. I don't know if any of your listeners have ever watched Now with Bill Moyers on Friday nights on PBS, a show that I found to be extraordinary, just so enormously thoughtful, so different from much of television. And there are pockets of good reporting from time to time. In entertainment show, much of it is so subjective. I have my own favorites. I love Arrested Development on Fox. There are some HBO shows. And HBO I consider to be just head and shoulders above just about everyone else on television.
Back to news. Is there any way around this situation that we've got this 24/7 news beast out there? Mm-hmm. And also, as viewers, as listeners, we demand it now.
Well, of course. I mean, that when I say we become desensitized, we become accustomed to it. And I think the longer it stays around, the more enduring it will become, because there are more and more people who are alive today who have no memory of life, certainly before television, but also before this 24/7 cycle, and that becomes their frame of reference. I acknowledge some of this may be generational. You know, it may be me comparing the world to the way it was 20, 30 years ago. That's always possible. But I think it's a real anomaly. It's a very interesting situation. We have more and more media and more outlets, but I think in many ways we are less informed, less better informed than we were before, because the quality of the information I don't think is as good. And part of it, I think, is because we do have these splintered attention spans where we demand more quicker, and we're not willing to wait for anything to unfold. I think of the election coverage, and I relate also the candidate debates to this, which I think celebrate all the wrong qualities you want in a candidate candidate. But if you think about it, the candidate who might possibly, after hearing a question, pause for 15 or 20 seconds to contemplate it, would immediately be labeled indecisive or foggy or musty, when in fact that is exactly the kind of president you would want, I would think. Someone who would weigh every question thoughtfully and not answer with a soundbite.
Yeah. Well, also, politicians are very aware of how the news media, especially the broadcast TV, radio, cable TV, how it works, and I think that they have responded by doing their own packaging. And so, you know, you have the debates. You also have written a column or two about the conventions.
Mm-hmm.
They offer us a lot of flash, but not a lot of substance.
Yeah, and the barriers are down. You know, most of the media accept this willingly because it's the easy thing to do. Again, if you have a lot of time to fill, if you're the 24-hour news channels, for example, anything that's live, you reach for. Anything that's fed to you, practically, you accept and you reach for because you need it. You need it to feed the beast. And even though the combined audiences of these 24-hour news channels is still small compared to the amount of viewership on network newscasts, the ABC and CBS and NBC shows, with their sprawl of morning shows, evening newscasts, and primetime news magazines, cannot afford to ignore stories that are granted stardom on CNN, Fox, and MSNBC, however puny they may be, because these 24-hour, 7 operations resonate everywhere. I mean, I would defy you to go into the halls of influence occupied by the nation's decision-makers and just try to find a congressional office or White House situation room that doesn't have TV monitors tuned to the cable's all-news channels. And we in the media also pay closely attention to them. And I think ultimately, even though it might be at glacial speed, what we consider to be the mainstream quality newspapers in this country will be gradually dragged along. I look at my own former newspaper, the L.A. Times, which in many respects I think is still a very great newspaper. But if you go back and look at the kind of news and the kind of coverage it gives certain kinds of news compared with what it did maybe 10, 15 years ago, there is a change, because no matter how principled, how thoughtful you may be, you are required, you must, to survive, respond to what's happening on television and on the Internet. People today, if there's a breaking news story, they don't wait for the morning paper. Mm-hmm. They turn on radio, they turn on television, or they go to the Internet.
Yeah. Well, I'm a big fan of the newspapers on the internet, but I can see what you're talking about. I mean, if I want to go and check on what's happening from the L.A. Times or the Washington Post or the New York Times, I can do that. Mm-hmm. And right there on the paper on the screen, it says updated 1:21 yeah. Eastern Standard Time.
Yeah.
And then also, which I think is very interesting, is the newspaper is telling you what stories to read. In other words, it says most emailed stories, you know, and you can go there and that's kind of a curious development too.
Yeah. Well, it's a multimedia world now. And, you know, I've always been a terrible futurist. I can't tell you what's going to happen in 10, 15 years. But I, you know, wouldn't be surprised at all that we ultimately get all our information from a small screen somewhere, whether it's newspapers on a screen, however. And it's a very interesting thing. And in a way, it almost isolates you from the rest of the world. I had this sort of bleak vision of people sitting in front of a television screen and not needing any kind of human contact anymore because they get it all from their television screen. But the technology is amazing, and it's wonderful if we can control it. But traditionally, it takes a long time before we were able to harness it, the technology at our fingertips. It usually moves faster than we move, and I think a danger is if news becomes driven by technology instead of vice versa.
Hmm.
I think live television, the emphasis on live television is an example of that.
Howard Rosenberg is our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. For 25 years, he was the television critic for the Los Angeles Times. He retired in 2003. Today, he teaches news ethics in the Annenberg School and criticism in the Film Television School at the University of Southern California. A collection of some of his columns, his criticism, now available in a book, Not So Prime Time, Chasing the Trivial on American Television. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with a telephone call. Questions, comments, they're welcome. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll free, 800-222-9455. That's 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. Well, as we've mentioned, you wrote a great deal about television news at the L.A. Mm-hmm. Times, and now you're teaching news ethics.
Mm-hmm.
What would you like to say? What are your thoughts about the controversy at CBS over the 60 Minutes Wednesday report on President Bush's National Guard service?
Yeah. Well, you know, I can't look into Dan Rather's mind, and the whole issue of whether he's biased is something that I can only speculate about. Just on the bias alone. Well, let me go back. Let me say that I think that the problem again is a function of speed, and speed has always been the danger of media. Going back years and years and years and years. The idea is to beat the competition, but ideally, if you want to beat the competition, you want to get it straight. And it's my opinion that what we have seen with CBS News this time is just a function of going too fast, a function of ineptitude. I think frequently what many Americans attribute to some kind of media conspiracy is just ineptitude. Many times we're human, we just do not do our job well. And I think that was the case. Having said that, I can understand people being suspicious because, number one, this is a very subjective appraisal, but if you watch Dan Rather enough, there are times on the air when he seems rather loopy. You know, he's very uptight. He's like he's going to fall apart on the air. Also, 12, 13 years ago, he appeared at a CBS affiliates meeting in New York, at which President Clinton was on satellite live and publicly lavished praise on the Clinton, something he never should have done. A few years later, he appeared at a Democratic fundraiser in Dallas, made an appearance at that event, which I think should have been a fireable offense, whether you're a Republican or a Democrat. He should never have crossed that line. And then there is the case of his of the producer on this piece, Mary Mapes, who also had a terrible ethical breach when she put her main source in contact with the Democratic National Committee or the Kerry campaign, in effect, delivering some kind of a collusive effort, which I think is just breaks all the rules. I can't look into her mind, but I have to assume that she is some way biased toward Democrats because of that action. But also, you know, we're all biased, and we have to accept that. It's how we respond to our biases as journalists that makes a difference. And if we're really professional, we can do our jobs in a disciplined way. I think it's going to have a profound impact on CBS because there are now many high expectations where CBS News goes from here. Do they go with the multiple anchors? Do they stay with a single anchor? Who will be chosen to anchor? What happens to Andrew Hayward, the CBS News president who was spared the axe?
Mm-hmm.
I think probably his time may come a little later. So there are a lot of high expectations out there. One of the things that's revealed, though, and a lot of people aren't aware of, is the influence of this sort of hidden component of television news, and that is the field producer. You know, most Americans watch the people on the air, especially at the networks, and think the reporters are doing all the work, or the star reporters. And much of the time, the behind-the-scenes work is done by these field producers who are the real reporters, and Mary Mapes is one of those.
Yeah. How does a news organization come back after suffering a blow to its credibility? CBS is not the only news organization that has had to deal with, a blow like this.
There was NBC with the Dateline story, in which they tampered with some trucks in an expose of General Motors vehicles, in which they sort of phoning up a display of a truck test, and in which they stood by that story a long time. NBC came back. CNN with its tailwind scandal, they came back from that. You know, I think CBS News can come back. In terms of the ratings, it's been down in the ratings for a number of years, and what happens there, there's no way of telling. In many ways, these people become sort of habits with viewers. It's whomever you get used to, that's who you watch. But I think ultimately CBS News will come back. It'll remain to be seen whether in the near future we still have three network news divisions. There's been a lot of talk about maybe one falling by the wayside, or maybe one or two will specialize in certain kinds of news, the way the British newspaper system does, for example.
Yeah. There has been talk that the network might shake up the format, and Les Moonves this week talked about maybe using the morning format as a blueprint, and Katie Couric's name and John Stewart's name have been bandied about.
Yeah, well, I think if they use the morning format as a model for their evening news, I think that would be a tragic, because you have to look at their own morning show, in which they do all kinds of games. I think it's very dishonest. There's something called cross promotion that's been rampant in this industry for many, many years, and that's manufacturing a news story that is self-serving in a way to promote your network, to promote an entertainment show. And the CBS Morning Program does just that every Friday morning. Every Friday, they do a long, involved feature on the Survivor episode of the previous evening. Not because it's a bona fide news story, not because it's important information, but because it's a way of promoting Survivor. And I think that's dishonest. The morning format is very chatty. CNN has largely gone to that. And I think it's a further distancing, I think, from really hard news. I think it's a bad way to go, but it may well be what they do.
What could be done to improve network news?
I really think it has to start with the public. There's a trend going across the country called media literacy being taught in schools. Mm. I think you have to start with kids. I think you have to start with young kids, and along with the three R's, so to speak, teach them about media literacy. Teach them about media, not necessarily only the economics of media and what's on media, but the potential of media. What they should expect from media, the promise of media, to elevate their standards at a very young age. so that then when they become adults like us, they will demand more. Because if they don't demand more, if the public doesn't demand more, what we have is what we will always get, and that will be the standard.
Hmm. The students that you work with today, how media savvy are they when they enter your classroom?
Well, it's mixed. Some are, some aren't. In terms of the history of media, most of them are amnesiacs. You know, I mean, one thing you learn when you teach, and maybe some of your audience know this well, as the older you get, your frames of reference become increasingly useless. I mean, probably half of my class, well, this is probably a slight hyperbole, but some probably won't even know who the Beatles are. So you have to change your frames of references, and what they lack, I think, is historical context, and I think that's the role of a teacher to provide that. But they're very much into the Internet and into the new technologies. They're very much into these so-called reality shows, which I think are mislabeled because they're not actually reality. But they're very much into that because they're so pervasive throughout all of television.
Yeah. They are pervasive, but why are they pervasive? We like them. But what are your thoughts about this phenomenon at the moment? I'm sure it will pass, you know.
Well, everything in television passes. Yeah. I have to tell you, my answer is search me. I've never gotten it. I never got Survivor. The whole phenomenon is just elusive for me. I just don't understand it. But that's, you know, that's what television should be. If there's an audience for something and it's not enormously harmful, then why not? But what you say is really true. Television is very cyclical, and what goes around comes around. 5 years from now, I guarantee you, we will not be talking about reality shows. And even call them is the reality is misleading, because I would suggest to you that if you're surrounded by television cable, if there's a camera in your face, if something you're doing is being tightly edited, it's not reality or only a form of reality. It's actually fictionalized reality.
Well, I don't know if we would watch reality, but we want to watch fantasy, and I think that's what
that is. Yeah, I think the problem is just in the labeling. But I think we have to understand that we're really not watching reality. I believe that the camera always has the ability to alter any kind of reality. There have been some documentarians. Frederick Weissman is one who made these wonderful fly-on-the-wall documentaries about institutions of society, in which somehow his camera seems to have gone unnoticed, and people go about what they're doing, and the result are these wonderful narratives about slices of American culture. But that's very rare. Most of the time, people on some level, I think, are aware of the camera and the act accordingly.
Let's talk with some listeners now. We've got a couple of listeners lined up and ready to talk with us. Our guest this afternoon, Howard Rosenberg, former critic for the Los Angeles Times, former television critic, winner of the Pulitzer Prize, a collection of his work now available, Not So Prime Time, Chasing the Trivial on American Television. Our first caller this afternoon on line one in Urbana. Hi.
Hi. Actually, we go back to, Newton Minow's comment about the vast wasteland. Mm-hmm. And it still exists today and probably even more. Hello?
Yeah. Well, if that's a question, do I think it still exists?
In terms of the comment, I mean, I guess it happened. I'll just raise a couple other things and then you can comment.
Sure.
We certainly have less diversity in the media with the corporate ownership.
Mm-hmm.
My view in terms of reporting, too much reporting is out of context and not more in depth, especially the, it doesn't give us the historical perspective of the situation we're in. I think the media ought to really do a little bit more of job in depth, and I know it's hard on TV, but certainly even the newspapers.
Yeah.
Connecting the points.
Yeah.
Currently, there's a situation that concerns me today, the Social Security, and all of a sudden, it's in trouble and all that kind of stuff. But a lot of people forget, why is it in trouble? Well, the government's spending the Social Security money, from my understanding. I mean, there's all these IOUs against the Social Security. The other one is certainly the Iraq World War. What role did the United States play in it? And when they talk about that were gassed and all this kind of stuff. The reality is that we were certainly part of the problem. Anyway, I'll hang up and let you comment.
Okay. I agree. Next question. No. Well, let me start with the last first. The problem always for all of journalists is to provide context, and it's especially difficult through. And I hate to keep picking on television, but why not? I'll do it. It's especially difficult on television because there's so little time. So this is a self-imposed limitation to tell a story. And I would let's take an evening newscast, for example, a network newscast, which is what 22 minutes after commercials. I would suggest to you that no matter how smart you are, or how good a journalist you are, you cannot tell the story of the world in 22 minutes. Consequently, we're limited, to time limits. A story that runs 2 minutes is practically a documentary. So it's very hard within that framework to provide context. And I agree with the caller, that's a big problem. Let me go to the first thing he mentioned. That's Newton Minow's famous comment that television was a wasteland. I would suggest that to a discerning viewer, television is very valuable. Most of television might be a wasteland, but whoever said that you should sit in front of this wasteland for 6 hours at a clip and expect it to inform you or delight you or enthrall you or entertain you? I think what we should learn to do is really be more discerning in our viewing, and I maintain, I certainly can, on any given night, I can find something I want to watch, not something that I find as less objectionable than other shows, something I want to watch, whether it's a half hour, whether it's an hour show. I think that's a much more intelligent way to watch television. I think it's there if we pick and choose. In terms of the lack of diversity, I think that's a very perceptive comment, even though there appears to be more diversity because of the new technologies, because of cable, because of independent television stations. The comment that caller made was exactly correct. We have, in terms of corporate power, we have more and more influence, more and more control in fewer and fewer hands. And what appears to be diversity, I would maintain, is not really diversity, because you have the same people owning these diverse elements and finding very creative ways to provide essentially the same kind of television. If I were to pick one threat that I see looming as the greatest threat facing media today, I think it's corporate ownership. And that's why I noted with interest today that Michael Powell is said to be resigning from the head of the FCC, someone who has really pushed for more deregulation in this area. And I think his own scenario was to have greater and greater control in fewer and fewer hands.
Let's talk with another listener. Caller in Champaign, line two. Hi. Listener in Champaign, line two. Let's go on to another call then. Line four, listener in Indiana. Good afternoon.
Hello. Two things, I guess. You just stopped talking about the one is the corporate entity emergence. Let's just assume things are going to be sound bites and there's not much we can do about it for the general populace and that the corporate people get to do some of the things they do. With Powell leaving, that's sort of interesting on its own, but the market, let's just, pull out the buzzwords, the market takes over. Do you see, you mentioned that some might already drop their news reporting. I'm thinking that it may turn into more like infomercials or something, that there'll be news as a basis, but you're going to have to look for the slick and the sexy and the flashy to keep that audience going, I wonder if you could speak to that. And I think that's enough, really. I had a second one, but it's not that important. I'm more interested in your view on that one. Thanks a lot.
Well, the old mantra has always been the line is blurring between news and entertainment. And my response is, what line? The line is almost no longer there. You have to, in some respects, all of us in the media are in the entertainment business. I'll take myself, for example. If in writing a column for many, many years, if in some form I didn't entertain people, if people fell asleep reading it, no matter how brilliant I might have been, I wouldn't have had a job. I mean, you have to keep people watching television. You have to keep people reading newspapers. So in some respect, You have to be an entertainer. It's when the balance goes haywire, that's where it becomes very problematic. And increasingly on television, that is what's happening. We were just talking for a minute about CBS. And another lesson, I think, of the CBS debacle is the power and influence of anchors as personalities. Many of us tend to watch news programs not because of how good or bad their news presentations may be, but because of the personalities, because of the theater of the moment, the theater of the process. And that's because they're presented to us as personalities, the messenger becoming at least as important, if not more important than the message, the format, which we see increasingly happening, becoming more important than what goes inside the format. Boy, I was watching ABC News last night. ABC News do a story in which I heard music. Okay? Music in a story. You're saying, what's the problem? You hear music in movies all the time. The big difference is the purpose of music in a movie is to enhance a feeling. I would suggest to you that should never be the case in journalism. You know, the news should stand on itself. It's a very subtle form of theater that I think has been creeping into news. The more obvious ones, of course, are all the flash that the caller talked about, and especially happens in local news shows where there's a lot of flash, a lot of happy talk, a lot of family stuff, a lot of stuff about the team coverage and that kind of thing that has been going on for a long time. But I'll tell you something that I've noticed. You know, the idea of news imitating entertainment has been happening a long time, but what's been happening in the last 5 or 6 years is entertainment looking more and more like news. Bill Maher's show on HBO, for example, I would suggest to you that probably has as much news credibility as many, which is an entertainment show, has as much news credibility as most news shows. And there was a poll out right before the election that I think 21% of Americans between the ages of 18 and 29 used Jon Stewart's The Daily Show on Comedy Central as a primary news source about the election. It's a very smart show, but it's satire. Mm-hmm. As he points out himself, it's phony news. But here we have this line blurring, all right, but it's entertainment becoming more like news. Very interesting.
Well, it was so funny to see him on the, now this is famous, you know, his going on Crossfire and saying, "Hey, you guys, the lead into my show is talking puppets making crank telephone calls." And also something that in one of your columns that's in Not So Prime Time, it's interesting, though, to see what leads into local news. It could be the Flintstones. It could be, you know, it.
The lead-in.
Yeah.
Well, the lead-in is always important. Yeah. I mean, it could be trapeze artists. It doesn't make any difference. And, you know, and the idea being, I guess, and this is a comment on us, that most of us are so lazy and inert that we won't bother to change the channel, that if we're watching one program, we're there watching the program that follows. And throughout the history of television, this has been the philosophy that's driven programmers, that get that first program right, and then the next programs will follow like dominoes. And, of course, I think, you know, Stewart was exactly right about Crossfire. Crossfire has been a joke for years. Actually, Crossfire has been, a joke since its inception. And the purpose of Crossfire, in my opinion, has never been information. The purpose is conflict. I mean, conflict becomes the message. People screaming at each other, and in much of talk television, that's also the purpose. And much of talk radio, it's conflict because for some reason, people are attracted to conflict, even if there is no illumination that accompanies it.
Yeah, well, a lot of those shows like Crossfire, they're theater, pure and simple.
Oh, sure. I mean, oh, no, there's no question about it. That's the purpose. Or if you get, you know, you just get two people, have two people on as guests, okay? And you have your Democrat and you have your Republican, classic. And if they really start screaming at each other and acting like idiots, you don't stop them. You let them go on because that's what's called, quote, great television, unquote. Well, it may be great television, but it's not great information. And again, you know, somehow Americans are attracted to this, just as television researchers will tell you that people somehow are attracted to a television screen when there's a live slide up there. That even when there's no reason to go live, that if you say you're going live somehow, that attracts people. I mean, why do we think that there's always a live stand, live intro and a live outro in a local news story? Why does somebody stand in front of a bush where somebody was raped 3 days ago and stand there live? Because he needs to be live? No, because it's theater, because somehow people are attracted to that kind of thing. And so, again, a lot of the blame belongs in the public. Same thing goes to a phenomenon in Los Angeles, and I'm sure it doesn't happen as often where you are. That is, are these inane car chases with cops. A couple nights ago, the ABC-owned station in Los Angeles blew off, and I'm telling you, blew off an entire newscast to follow cops following somebody on one of the freeways. And more often than not, the reporters reporting this don't even know what the person is suspected of. The idea is that there's a chase going on and people should be interested in the why do they do it? They're not dummies. They do it because their research shows them that people like to watch these car chases. Go figure.
Hmm. Who are the best television critics working today?
Well, traditionally, I mean, Tom Shields of the Washington Post is utterly just out of sight brilliant. He's always been brilliant. And, you know, there are a lot, I hate to even judge them because there are a lot of people I don't even know about. Look, when I was working in the Louisville Times, at the Louisville Times, I mean, I thought, my God, here I am, this brilliant Howard Rosenberg. More of the world should know about me. No one knew who I was. I'm being ironic here. Don't take me literally. but it's really true. There are a lot of people working probably that I never even read who are just terrific. But Shales has always been just wonderful for the Washington Post.
Yeah. I've been struck the last few days, Frank Rich.
Oh, okay.
At the New York Times. It's just been blistering.
Frank Rich, if you were to ask me who my favorite columnist is writing today, it would be Frank Rich of the New York Times.
And he's been writing recently about television and media.
Well, but see, that what he does so wonderfully is, we talked about pulling all the, one of your callers called about pulling all the threads together. That's what he does as a columnist, as a cultural columnist. He takes everything from television, from movies, to theater, to internet, and pulls them all together in a very cogent way. Mm. It makes a lot of sense. It is very, very smart. Plus, it doesn't hurt that he's a wonderful writer. But he is just incredibly smart, and he has been very blistering lately. And look, blistering is required much of the time. You know, I think the worst, I don't know about you, what I really dislike reading is somebody who, after the end of the column, you don't know how they stand. Mm. I think he's quite wonderful.
Yeah. There's a critic also working for the Washington Post who writes on media, who I think is very good, and I'm blanking.
You're talking about Howard Kurtz?
Howard Kurtz, yes.
Well, Howard's very smart. Howard is less a critic than a media reporter.
Okay.
And he's also on CNN. It's an interesting case with Howie Kurtz. He's a very smart guy who does very good work, but, you know, he also works for CNN. Now, is this not a conflict of interest? I mean, you know, because CNN comes under his umbrella as a media writer for the Washington Post, and it's a conflict that sort of escaped most people, but it's very interesting. Mm. Yeah, but Howie Kurtz is very smart.
Yeah, he's also a person who pulls things together for
us. Yeah, no, absolutely. And he's written some books on that. But most of the people, I don't know, it's TV criticism has not been the highest of arts through the years. It's fun to write about. Television is fun to write about, and it's very easy to just regurgitate whatever you're told by the television networks. You know, for years they have these annual junkets. Well, now they're biannual to Hollywood and Los Angeles, in which television critics and television editors and television writers come out here and are served a lot of stuff by the people who make television. And you know, they have sort of a captive audience, and it's not a very healthy way to write about any kind of a medium or any kind of an industry, but it happens. And after a while, if you do it long enough, and it's always a danger in any kind of journalism, you start to view yourself as an extension of the industry, of the beat that you cover, and that's always very dangerous.
There we have to leave it. We're out of time. Howard Rosenberg, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you so much. I really enjoyed it.
For 25 years, Howard Rosenberg was television critic for the Los Angeles Times. He retired in 2003. Today, he teaches news ethics in the Annenberg School and criticism in the Film Television School at the University of Southern California. You can find a sampling of his work in a collection of his columns just published. Its title is Not So Prime Time, Chasing the Trivial on American Television. The book is published by Ivan R. D. 8 minutes before 2 o'clock Central Time, settlement prices should be in from the Chicago Board of Trade. Here's Todd Gleason.
Thanks very much, Celeste. From the Chicago Board of Trade, on this Friday afternoon, futures finished the day like this. In the wheat pit, they were down a penny and three quarters. Or I'm sorry, I'm reading. That's the weekly settlement price. Grabbed the wrong sheet. Dave Dickey is very quick with getting the numbers figured from week to week, and I just put the wrong sheet in front of me. March wheat now was down, or rather up a penny on this day, and settlement price was at 295 and three quarters for the day. Had a high of 294, or rather 297 and three quarters, and a low at 294 and a quarter. May wheat futures, the high 304 and three quarters, the low at 301 and a quarter. Settlement price there at 302 and three quarters. They were up a half on the day. In July contract, a 311 and three quarters high, the low at 308 and a half. Settlement price at 309 and three quarters, penny and a half higher. September futures up 1.5, 317 and a half the high, the low at 314 and a half, and the SEP settled at 315 and a half. December contract for the wheat pit, 326 the high, the low at 323 and a half, settled at 324. They were up a half at the end of the day. March corn on this Friday afternoon, a high of 198 and a quarter, the low at 196 and a quarter. Settlement price at $1.97 a bushel. They were down three quarters of a cent. May futures, 205 and a quarter high, low at 203 and a half. Settlement price at 204 and a quarter, down a half for the day. And the July is 212 the high, the low at 210 and three quarters. Settled 211 and a quarter, down a quarter of a cent. September futures, 219 and a quarter, the high, the low at 218 and a half. Settlement price, 218 and three quarters, down a quarter. And the December contract in the corn pit, $2.29 a bushel, the high, the low at 227 and three quarters. The new crop settled unchanged at 228 and a half. March corn futures, 236 and a half for next year, the high, the low at 235 and three quarters. And the March 2006 corn, $2.36 a bushel. They finished unchanged on the day. March oats, 173, the high, the low at 168. Settlement price there, 170 unchanged. And the May futures, a 158 and a quarter high, low at 153. Settlement price at 156 and three quarters. And they were up three quarters. From the soy complex, beans were off between 5 and 6 cents for the day. And on the week, these numbers were in. The March contract weekly settlement price, March to March, down 25, and rather the lead option changed, it's March to January, down 25 and a quarter cents. We'll talk about that and what it might mean to the marketplace with Glenn Ring on Commodity Week this Saturday morning at 11:30 a.m. Be sure to tune in for that, and stay tuned this afternoon as well when we'll talk with Mike Zuzlo, Risk Management Commodities out of Lafayette, Indiana, about the 6.5 cent drop in the March contract on this Friday afternoon. 516 and three quarters was the settlement price there. That March had a high of 524 and a half, and the beans the low at 515 and a half. Once again, the settlement there at 516 and three quarters, down 6.5 cents. May beans, 521 and a half the high, the low at $5.14 and three quarters cents, and a settlement price at $5.16. They were off a nickel. July futures in the bean pit, 526 and a half the high, the low at 519 and three quarters. Settlement price at 520 and three quarters, down 5 and a quarter. And the August contract, a 527 and a half high, low at 522 and a half. Settlement price at $5.23. They were down 5.5 cents. September futures, 526 and a half the high, the low at $5.24. Settled 524, down 5.5 cents. November, this is the new crop, 539 the high, the low at 532. Settled 532 and three quarters, and they were down a nickel as well. The bean meal, March contract at 159.20, low high, that is, and a low at 155.30. Settlement price at 155.80. They were off 310. May bean meal, 158, the high, the low at 154.50. Settled 155.20, down 250. March oil at 19.67 on the high, the low at $19.47. Settled 19.58. They were up 2 cents for the day, and the May bean oil up a nickel. 1977, the high, the low at 1960. May bean oil settled 1969. Once again, that contract was up a nickel. Now here's Celeste Quinn with the numbers from the Mercantile Exchange. Good afternoon to you, Celeste.
Hi, Todd. Thank you very much. Let's take a look at what happened today on the Merc. It looks like lean hogs finished up, live cattle lower, and feeder cattle mostly higher. January feeders, 106.25, the high 105.70, the low, the settlement 105.72 and a half, that down 47 and a half. March, 101.37 and a half, the high $100.55, the low 101.25, the settlement, that up 42 and a half. April, $100.60, the high 99.85, the low $100.52 and a half, the settlement, that up 27 and a half. February live cattle 89.55, the high 89.02 and a half, the low, the settlement 89.27 and a half, that down 25. April 88.15, the high 87.60, the low 87.90, the settlement, that down 7 and a half. February lean hog 76 even, the high 74.80, the low 75.87 and a half, the settlement, that up 152. April 76.90, the high 75.95, the low 76.60, the settlement, that up 97 and a half. May 76.85, the high 76.05, the low 76.82 and a half, the settlement, that up 75. June 79 even, the high 78 even, the low 78.95, the final price, that up 97 and a half. February bellies 94.67 and a half, the high, the low 93.52 and a half, the settlement today 94.10, that up 37 and a half. The Dow is off 64 points at 10,408. The NASDAQ down 9 at 2037. The S&P 500 off 6 at 1170.
The Carl Center for Rural Health and Farm Safety is proud to underwrite agricultural programming on WILL. The center helps residents of rural communities with education and training in farm safety. For more information, call 217-383-4606.
It's time once again to Ask Dr. Science. So let's ask Dr. Science.
That's me.
Remember, he knows more than you do.
That's right.
Jan Koopman from Chapel Hill, North Carolina writes, "Dear Dr. Science, whenever I try to use the copy machine in my office, it jams. It will work perfectly for the person before me, but the second I try to use it, it signals that the paper has been stuck in some place that I can't seem to get to. Is there something wrong with me?"
Of course there's something wrong with you. People don't write to Dr. Science if they're feeling good about themselves. You have an obvious need for approval from duplicating devices. This is not an uncommon condition. Left untreated, it could lead to severe or even. If I were you, I'd start by changing my attitude. Copy machines can spot a whiner all the way across the office. The next time you approach the machine, assume a nonchalant attitude, whistle a happy tune, and copy away in a